You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Angela Hopkins. Angela, it's good to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
So Angela, the way the show starts is with a big question. Who are you? What do we need to know about you to start this conversation?
Well, my name's Angela Hopkins. I was born and raised in Dayton, Ohio. And I am a Quaker. I became a Quaker in Kenya, which is a little different from many Quakers here in the U.S. The context is a little different. People talk about having a culture shock when they go from one culture to the next. Having the experience of becoming a Quaker in Kenya and then coming back to here as a Quaker is different.
Right, and coming back to here. So you started out in the U.S. and then at some point in your life you went to Kenya and converted and became a Quaker.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. And then came back to Kenya. Came back from Kenya and also as traveling around the continent of Africa as a Quaker and then coming back here and kind of taking up this sense of call that I have in regards to racism. I was born and raised as a Baptist, and my whole sense of call, the things that I as a person of faith are the same. They're just different awarenesses that have happened because of the experiences that I've had.
The same as being called in a Baptist tradition.
Yes.
Right. But they're okay. So yeah, cool.
Yeah.
But you're also other. There are other pieces of your life too. No.
Oh yes.
To start.
I am a grandmother. I have 10 grandchildren. I have 3 children and who live all over the world. So,
Cool. Yeah. So we're gonna cut to music. What should we play first? What should we open with?
Well, there's a song that is like my motivational song, and it's called "The State of the World" by Janet Jackson. I do anti-racism work. Currently, the Friends Center for Racial Justice in Ithaca. Mm-hmm. And whenever I'm going out, this is the song that gets me through my driving periods and keeps me motivated.
Right.
Time to play.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this episode is Angela Hopkins. Angela, what experiences, what commitments have helped to shape the life that you value and the life that you live now?
I would have to say that there was an early experience for me when I had gone to school. I wanted to be a teacher, and I was very keyed into helping students learn. That was the focus of what I thought I was called to do. And it wasn't long that I recognized that it was really the life of the students that was really drawing me in, their conditions, helping them to be a better person. That was the thing that really motivated me.
Right.
And I had my children, and my husband was in the Navy, and so we had these short stints in which we were going to be there too long to just kind of sit around and do nothing, but not long enough to really get some firm roots.
Right.
During that process, I was substituting, and I did some work in a special needs class, and then really had this wonderful experience of recognizing, this is my first experience of coming to that understanding there is that of God in everyone. That is one of Quaker's foundational understandings. Mm-hmm. And began to really recognize the ableness of every human being. And over the years, as I explored and kind of reflected on that, it was kind of like an onion peeling. You know, there were different facets that really brought me back to this understanding. And that was probably the most fundamental thing experience in my whole life that really brought me to the place that I am mm-hmm. right now. I learned as an educator that being connected with my student, really, I learned a lot from them, and that helped me not only to be a better educator, but a better human being. And from then on, it just kind of, it's kind of like a, like I said, like that onion that peels away.
So initially you're in a classroom and you're teaching and you have a fairly defined role. But you're just, I mean, what I sense is that you're more concerned with the formation of persons.
Yes.
And their choices and your engagement of them mm-hmm. and their choices. How did you, that's how I would approach teaching, but that's not how a lot of teachers approach teaching. How did you differentiate? How did you live that value in the classroom? And when did you find you needed to get out of a classroom and find another way to live?
Well, I think that really the initial motivation is recognizing that the differences in learning and people's mm-hmm. learning styles. Sure. I had three children of my own that learned differently, and because of our situation and moving around, we did some homeschooling, and just recognizing how people can thrive they're in a context in which they thrive.
They're comfortable, they're curious, and they're ready to go.
Yes, yes. My first awareness of really wanting to teach was, there's a book by, I think it's Rachel Carson called, I've lost the title now.
Her breakthrough book, which was Silent Spring, or this is another book?
No, it was something in regards to nature, but it really kind of helped me to see just kind of the beauty in the world and recognizing that beauty in others. And so that kind of what kind of set me forward there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So how did you get from moving around, Navy relocations, raising kids in the States, to Kenya and then back again?
Well, we were stationed in the Washington, D.C., Maryland area. And at that time, I was a part of a Baptist community that was very interracial mm-hmm. and culturally racial, so culturally different. So we had people from all over the world, because in D.C. there are a lot of people that come from overseas. There are a lot of folks that work there temporarily from overseas. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really interesting experience for me in terms of just kind of working in a faith community where people have differences that that you don't experience when you're working in a faith community in which the context, we're all the same.
Is one dominant racial
one is or one
cultural
dominant.
Background. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what did you, what did you learn about raising and addressing racial issues in that setting that seems to have made it a formative piece of how you work? Because you're now at the Friends Center for Racial Justice, and in the time since then, you've migrated from the Baptist Church to Quakers, and I don't necessarily see that as a large step, although there are ways in which it is, but there are ways in which it's not.
Well, there are lots of other traditions that that were between those two experiences.
Yes, okay.
So in many ways, it was kind of like coming full circle.
Right. You have an American life.
Yeah, very much an American life. And during that time in Maryland, there was this book study that was like the rage. Uh-huh. Everyone was doing this study, and it was a book by called Experiencing God, Knowing and Doing the Will of God, which back then was the term, what we would call discernment, spiritual discernment. And had a really wonderful experience. I, of course, with my background and my just love of children, I was directing the nursery and the preschoolers, and everyone did this study. So there was a study in which the pastor's minister's message was around this theme, and each group, whether we're talking about the retired folks and the high school students and the preschoolers, were all we were doing the same study. And and after that, it went right into discerning our gifts and calls.
Right.
And as an educator in the church, there's always a shortage for people to help out in the nursery.
Yep.
Through the process of us doing the study of looking at our gifts, we had this wonderful thing happen. There was a man who had been working on our books. He was a wonderful accountant. We had another gentleman that was a lawyer. And folks had been doing these things on behalf of the church for just all these times. And then this one man came up. He said, "What I really want to do is play the guitar." And so, as you know, we all, as we do what's called evoking the gifts of one another, we recognize that if we had, you know, some of the women that all they wanted to do is sit and rock the babies would come and do that. And this gentleman who had been our accountant would come and play the guitar, because in that area we have tons of lawyers and accountants.
Yeah.
Teachers were able to have breaks and they could plan, and the children got this wide experience of diverse people in our community. And I just recognized that basically what that did was we looked at our structure. Mm-hmm. And in reflecting, that's what I realized. That was my first call to looking at structure in terms of our spiritual faith communities.
Right.
And recognize that what are the things that we're doing that are really the essence of our communities in terms of our faith? And what are the things that are actually cultural traditions? And then having left that experience with that diversity and being in communities that are very homogeneous, right, saying, what are the things that we can tweak? Asking one another, what are the things that are the essence of our communities? And what are the things that are cultural essence that we can just let go of some of these things?
Right.
We often talk about making room for the different voices at the table. Well, you know, we may just have to set a new table, you know,
we
in terms
of... We might
have
to build a whole new house.
We might have to build a whole new house.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's the work in which I feel called to. I'm known as an activist. I consider myself a spiritual activist. So activism is seen and defined by different things to many people. The foundation of the work that I feel too is basically looking at our structures and helping one another look and evoking the gifts of one another. And what are the things that we can do to tweak our structure so that we can make room for other voices and other traditions to come into our community. Right. I am very touched by the fact that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated time of our weeks. Mm-hmm. It bothers me. I'm very grateful for all of the different experiences that we're now engaging in to kind of work on that. But we still have a long way to go.
Right, right. And I want to come back. When you talked, you started, you've covered a lot of material here, and I want to come back. And in discerning people's gifts, those gifts are in part an expression of their core religious experience as defined in the tradition they honor. Mm-hmm. By their lives and by their participation. They're also defined by cultural experiences and personal talents and stuff. But it seems like you are, in the discernment process, you are trying to find where people could willingly give of themselves and joyfully give of themselves, and how you could cut through some of these cultural assumptions, which are like old habits. Sometimes they're meaningful, but sometimes they're just the old habits, and get at the core of the religious tradition. And playing music or holding the babies was a piece that was personally called to, that met a very basic lesson for the congregation.
I see the discernment of gifts in a particular context as something we don't necessarily look at what it is you do on the outside world, I call it. That may be something that you do very well, and you may be the best person at that church to do that particular
task.
Most
people who do it in the outside world, they don't want to do it at church.
They don't want to do it. Yeah. And that's how come it's important for us to really delve into it. And it may be something that you do extremely well and that you love doing. I think it's important for us to look at, at our gifts, but also look at our experiences that kind of affect where we place our feet. Mm-hmm. It may be a thing that gives us a sense of confidence and we can do this thing, but sometimes that's not exactly where God may want us to be. May be in a situation where we need to learn something new or move aside so that the gifts of another individual can be encouraged and supported in our communities. Mm-hmm. So just because you do it, even in the same faith community, for this particular time, this may not be the time that you're being led to do that particular gift.
Right, right. And that's a process in the Quaker tradition of discernment, or in the Friends tradition. I mean, you use the term Quaker without judgment and without defensiveness, and some people would rather use the term friend.
I fluctuate back and forth between Quaker and friend. I recognize the difference in the terminology, and I'm comfortable with either.
Yeah, yeah, and I just want to note that. Now, when a person... we live in a county here that is a Christian minority. We live in a county that is roughly half non-religious and half religious or religious and spiritual. Less than 25% of people here belong to any congregation, Christian, Unitarian, Jewish, mm-hmm. Muslim community, Buddhist, Sangha, whatever you want to, we just aren't as a community. But what you're describing, though, is how people... By finding a community they want to be part of, and in your case, a Quaker Friends congregation, they also are able to explore parts of their lives that they wouldn't get to explore otherwise, because the community calls it out of them or creates in a moment where they can discern that I need to do something that I've never done before, and it's scary, and I have these people around me to do it. And that's powerful. We don't oftentimes avail ourselves of community in that way. And on the secular side, there aren't a lot of traditions where we come together in that way for each other.
One of the things as a friend that we acknowledge, there's a wide spectrum of friends. Mm-hmm. Some Quakers are theists, yep. Some are non-theists.
Some are Christians.
Some are Christians, and some are another faith tradition. But we all believe that that, as we said, that there's that of God in everyone, and we have a direct experience with the Spirit. So in terms of our journeys, we do not expect that journey to look the same mm-hmm. in each individual person. And one of the things of having the freedom to explore other traditions is that in many ways it helped me come back and to really reclaim certain traditions that may not be prevalent today, but that are really in our roots, such as the experience of discernment and silence, mm-hmm. or the covering of one's hair. Muslims aren't the only ones. There's Catholics, and there's an experience in the scriptures for that.
And the Mennonite and the Amish.
Yeah.
And, you know, and my mother wore something over her hair whenever she left the house until the 1970s when her daughters teased her out of it.
Oh.
Because they it was too old-fashioned.
So coming back and being able to claim those part of the traditions that really speak to you, that's important.
Yeah. It sounds like the Friends are trying to be a place where anyone of any background can come to be in community with each other. When you say that of God in each person, I think it also requires an experience of the Spirit. Atheists who are comfortable with God language oftentimes understand that God means, in many ways, the whole. You're a part of the whole, a part of reality. And reality is beyond our comprehension and control. So it may be spooky and it may be not. We can't say that with certainty. But we experience more than we can contain or control. And that is a powerful lesson, particularly for a community like this one.
Yes, and one of the things that I have experienced, because when I returned to the States, technically, I was we've always sent missionaries over to different places in the continent of Africa, but I was actually being sent as a missionary to the U.S.
Your African community sent you.
Yes, it's important to kind of experience the diversity within that context. So for a long time, I traveled. It's called being a released friend, and what that means is that you're released from your local community to travel among friends. And that experience, really, I learned a lot from that in terms of appreciation for the diversity of not only in our tradition, but just in people in general.
Right. And the language that you use, to be a released friend, it means that you're freed from that local community. And that implies that the community has claims on our lives.
Yes.
That we can hold each other to, but also that we discover what we're capable of in that community.
Right.
And it's been decided that you have a gift for bringing other people into awareness or relationship that needs to be shared with many different communities, and you'll have the support of your home community, but you're not, that's not the only place you're going to be.
Yes, and I guess the technical term really is you're being released from your local community to travel in ministry on behalf of your local community.
Right, yeah.
So it's
But we don't think of commitment in such a way that we would use that language in everyday use. It's powerful. It's powerful.
Yeah.
Let's take a moment to cut to music. I'm going to do the idea station ID, and you tell me what to play next. You're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Angela Hopkins. What should we play?
I don't know. What's the other?
We have Living in a World They Didn't Make, Here I Am, Lord, and we have This Is My Song.
Living in the World They Didn't Make.
Okie dokie. Here we go. And do you want to say something about it before I play it?
Yes, I will.
Sure. Go ahead.
So one of my favorite songs, I have to admit I listen to a variety of music, and one of the albums on that same album of Rhythm Nation, which is really encompasses activism, a concern for the planet, as well as a concern for our community. this song means a lot to me because it helps helps me stay connected to the care of the earth, which is important for friends and should be important for all of us, I believe, and care for the young people and recognizing that they have different challenges to deal with than we had to deal with and our sense of responsibility. Right.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Angela Hopkins. So, Angela, you are a released Quaker, and you are serving the Friends Center for Racial Justice. What is that? How did you come to Ithaca? How did you discern that Ithaca was the right place?
Well, I think I should probably connect to start at my experience in sure. Kenya. So when we think of Quakers, for those of us who, you know,
you think feel of Quakers. Real as real well,
recognize, you know, here in the States that most Quakers are European American descent. When I was in Kenya, most of the Quakers there were African descent. Mm-hmm. So they were African. So my initial experience of Quakers was in a community of friends of African descent.
Sure.
One night I was having this conversation with my pastor. She and I were traveling, and she was sharing. It's kind of, I call it one, John Boy conversations, you know. The Waltons, we're laying in bed and we're having these conversations. And she was saying, she shared about something that really touched her heart. She was talking about how when European American friends come to Kenya, that there's a different relationship. They said there's an appreciation for that gift that European American friends bring, and there's a certain respect. And she said, I just wish that that there was the same kinds of things in all of the meetings that I see in Kenya. And I shared with her, I said, we have a term for that in the U.S., and we call it internalized oppression. And what that means is that when there's an appreciation for the gift of another community, but not being able to recognize that gift within your own community, and it happens in many situations in which there's a lot of colonization and different experiences that come in to create where we are. So I told her about that experience, internalized racial oppression, and how that can affect your perception, not only of the gifts or the intelligence, but also in terms of our definition of beauty, how we define what is beauty to us. If my hair is naturally curly, in our African tradition, what does that mean in terms of good hair being called straight hair? Right. So we had all of these conversations and explaining to her, that we look at those things and that's what it means that's an important part of our work with mm-hmm. one another. It's an important part of anti-racist work because there's another part called internalized racial dominance as well as internalized racial inferiority.
Right.
And so this understanding, I guess the term, today's term, is white privilege. There's a lot of conversation about white privilege and what that means in terms of a dominant group being able to name and assign value in a society. And so one of the things that I was involved in doing once I came back to the States was in terms of white privilege. And I was on the National Committee for the White Privilege Conference in Philadelphia and doing some work within the Society of Friends around anti-racism and did a series of meetings and spending time with friends in Ithaca. And they asked me to come here. And so that's how I came to Ithaca.
Right. But that's how you got invited to Ithaca, but how did you decide, given how this is a very white place? I mean, it's 80% white and it's a very privileged place, and the poor have been largely asked to leave because they can't afford to live here. How did you decide that this was the place mm-hmm. to come and do your work, and what is your work?
And part of that's really interesting because part of the question that that the committee, as well as myself, looked at is what is that common is there a common call? Because most of the communities of Friends are predominantly, if not all, Friends of European descent.
And they're well-educated and they tend to be affluent.
So what is the difference between the community that I was in to coming to this community when we have acknowledged the fact that we're looking at our experiences as friends and being welcoming and inclusive and really focusing on the issues of justice and the things that keep us separate? What is the difference between the call where I was and the call to being here? And so the community looked at that. And I shared and did a lot of reflection around what that means. We recognized that there's something missing in our structure. There's a book out called Waking Up White. And in this book, it talks about all of the things that European Americans don't see through their lens. And basically, the meeting really felt that they were recognizing that their meeting was all white, they really felt led to what we say entering into the same call for the Friends Center for Racial Justice. Not only the Friends in Ithaca, but Friends throughout our year, what we call our yearly meeting, which is New York, parts of Connecticut, New Jersey, and Friends throughout the world have recognizing this. So we have all sorts of organizations as friends. We work on, you know, legislation, we work on all of these things, but we did not have a Friends Center for Racial Justice. That is a specific place in which friends can come to do their issues, do their work on racial justice, and we recognize the importance of having a structure that and a place
right.
where friends... We meet one another during, we're about to enter yearly meeting season. That's this time when we visit one another throughout the U.S. and overseas. So we recognized that there was not a place and time for friends of color to be able to be in relationships with European Americans to work on the issues of racism that arise in day-to-day situations and to really address some of the structural challenges. So that is the difference between the work in the Friends Center for Racial Justice and many of our other communities. Mm-hmm. Friends mm-hmm. have worked on the issue of you know, slavery to abolitionists. Historically, we've been connected in that specific call. Right. But recognizing that there is a lens in which European American view things, and there's certain experiences that are not present in our community with the absence of the other voice.
Right. And the book Fit for Freedom, Not for Friendship.
I'm glad you know that
yes.
book.
Oh, yes. Yes. That captures that dilemma for the French Quaker tradition.
Yes. It's a very good book written by Vanessa July and Donna. They did a really wonderful job of dealing with the historical positive experiences of friends, but acknowledging where we are today and the challenges that we're facing.
You're the Center for Friends Center for Racial Justice is occupying a well-known and historic place in Ithaca. It's the Burt House, that is an iconic place for many people who know the Quaker community, but now it is dedicated as the Friends Center for Racial Justice.
Yes, and we have kind of an interesting structure because when Friends in Ithaca, they had been trying to discern what to do with the Burt House, and we were very blessed to have it bequeathed to us. So realizing the need for this structure, it was like, so how do we create a space where we can bring voices together? And we have a very interesting structure in that I call it the two hands. So we have the local community of folks from Ithaca Meeting in the surrounding areas who are engaged in our work, but we have the Friends Center for Racial Justice Coordinating Committee. And those are European Americans as well as friends of color who come together to kind of carry the vision, create programming, to work with different meetings and individuals, and on the issue of racism and racial justice. Mm-hmm. So it's the one structure that we have and the one place that's there ongoing for folks who want to come to do workshops, silent reflection, retreats, just a variety of things.
Neat. What are, and you have an event coming up to help support this this initiative. It's the Justice for All concert and sing-along.
Yes, we're having this concert, and it's on Friday, April the 7th at 7:30 p.m. And there are two friends, Annie Patterson and Peter Blood. They are wonderful singers and have created the songbook that
many people know this book.
Yeah. Rise Up Singing, and they've just published another one, Rise Again. And they said, okay, we want to do a benefit. So they're coming along with a friend of theirs, Leah Gilmore, who also does blues, jazz, gospel singing. All three of these are activists that are really engaged and connected with the work of anti-racism. So,
and the proceeds from this fundraiser, it's going to be at the Unitarian Church, Unitarian Society of Ithaca, on Friday, April 7th at 7:30 p.m. And the proceeds from this fundraiser go to support the Friends Center for Racial Justice.
That's right.
Yes. So I encourage you to think about that. It's just good to get to know how these issues are being taken up and to see them taken up in a way which doesn't navel gaze on Ithaca. We have a whole kind of activist tradition here that is much more inward looking than it is deeply and richly connected to the communities immediately and beyond us. And I think that's especially around issues of race and economic class.
Well, the important thing, if I had to do like what is one line that reflects the vision of the Friends Center,
sure,
for Racial Justice, it would be a cross-pollinization process. So not only were friends of color not able to kind of connect with European Americans on a regular basis around this work, mm-hmm, but friends doing anti-racism work in New England yearly meeting, and yearly meetings are the time of how we differentiate friends who are located in different structures.
Right, and by structures, it would be like what people would know as a diocese or as a larger region.
Exactly.
Or a conference in the Methodist language.
Right. So, you know, there were friends who were doing this work in New England, and then friend in Baltimore yearly meeting, and friends in Philadelphia yearly, mm-hmm, meeting. And if we were lucky, we would get together and we would yearly meeting hop during the summer, which is quite extensive. But we didn't know one another.
Right.
We didn't know who was working on, who had a call for Native American concerns. And it's important to note that racism is not just a European American and an African American context. So the work we do is throughout our communities. And that's one of the things that I think that the experience from Kenya helps me to kind of recognize the context. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time in Burundi and Rwanda, and they have a different context of the same kinds of experiences.
Right. I want to switch gears just a bit here. One of the things that I love to learn, and I think the listeners to the show have come to expect, is to hear from the guests, what do you do to take care of yourself? And how do you know you need to do it, you know, emotionally, intellectually, physically, on a daily, weekly, monthly, throughout the day, yearly? I mean, you know, how do you know, how have you learned to take care of this piece of God in you, this that of God in you?
Well, when I was in the Washington, D.C. area, I was a part of a community called the Church of the Savior Tradition, and we had what we called mission groups, and we met, and basically it was for what we call accountability, which is, mm-hmm, all the things that you were talking about. And some of the things that I was kind of called on the carpet for was, I actually ran the after school program there, and during my first, we're going to have, you know, after 90 days, they sit down and they tell you, you know, these are the things we see that are good. These are the things you need to work on. And one of the things that I was told was that you're spending too much time in the office. You need to these are your working hours, and then you need to leave. I had never worked at a job when I was told I was working too much. So it was quite a shock to me. And my mission group held me to that in terms of that. And other things in terms of our own personal spiritual discipline, not just a general tradition that everybody looks at, but what are the things that you need to do? I'm up early and am I getting enough rest? Am I eating the things that I need to eat? As well as how am I nourishing my spirit? And, teaching about prayer is not the same as praying, all of those things. Right. And we have a process that we call a care support, committee. Are people who meet with you and have a conversation about how are you doing,
How often does that conversation happen?
It depends on the particular individual and the mm-hmm. care committee. They kind of set up the guidelines for that. If there is a particular concern that you would like support, and just kind of bouncing things off, we call that a clearness committee.
And you call it yourself when you need it.
Yes. And it could be anything around, I'm considering marriage. Mm-hmm. And it's not about folks telling you what to do. It's about folks who are really deeply listening to the things that you say and the things between the lines, the things that are not said. And really listening and evoking questions and invoking in a process in which you kind of talk out loud to yourself and reflect.
And I've heard it said that this is sometimes where people first hear their own voices.
Yes.
Because they haven't really heard their own voice, because they haven't been with people who reflect back to them the sounds and the concerns as they hear them.
Yes, and for me, it helps me to kind of focus in, because there are all kinds of voices that we hear, not just in terms of people, but some of the things we were talking about earlier in terms of status, in terms of
things that call
beauty.
On us.
Right. It's kind of like, so am I doing this because it nourishes my spirit? It is something that really I feel led to do? Or is this something that it's a good thing to do because, that's an extra X amount of dollars per year or
somebody
whatever.
Needs it, but I'm just filling a gap because really somebody else has better skill than I do.
And that's one of the most important things that our support committees do is help us to really focus in, because there are so many things in the world in which we can do. And I personally believe that there is a calling on our lives. Mm-hmm. And if we take the time to really breathe and listen, then all of those outside things can kind of shed away, and we're able to find what is it in the world that needs our attention and that we're really called to work on specifically.
Mm-hmm. How does, I'm going to throw this back to you personally. What do you do to take care of yourself physically? Emotionally, intellectually, this discernment process gets at pieces of it, and you get up early. Do you dance? Do you exercise? How do you connect yourself physically?
So the first thing that I do, I've come to a different community.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in Ithaca since August. Prior to that, I was coming for about a year, different times. The first thing that I do is I say to my community, I have a terrible time with X, Y, and Z.
Right.
I have a terrible time with, making sure that I eat on time. My blood sugar spikes. I'm supposed to do. So I tell them all the things that I have trouble for.
You work with abandon, I assume.
And the thing that is important about that is that it's good for them to know your gifts too, but where they can help you most is with the challenges. So So I meet with these different friends for a variety of reasons, but, you know, I am constantly aware that, oh, I'm going to go to this movie, and this person is going to be there, and she's going to ask me what I had to eat today. So it's that kind of thing. It's kind of like wearing a string on your finger,
right?
You know,
right. Yeah.
Doing that kind of work.
And we don't often appreciate, I used to, if you cannot ask for help, you're not in a very good position to offer help.
That's true.
And if you, and oftentimes those where you do just one or just the other, that's a sign of some kind of institutionalized or internalized oppression.
Yes. And it's cause to kind of reflect on why is it you're doing the things that you're right. doing. Yeah, that's really important as well.
Yeah. What do you do? How do you cultivate friendships over time? You travel and you live in many spaces. You have kids and grandkids all over the U.S. and maybe beyond. How do you maintain those relationships? The continuity that's part of life too.
Well, first I'd like to, I think it's important to kind of say that I do believe, I personally believe that there is a spiritual journey mm-hmm. for us. And for me, the process of discerning where I'm to go and when I'm to go has nothing to do with how it feels.
Right. But the process engages everybody around you.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And sometimes you're called to come to a place is not a place that feels like it's going to be really nice, you know?
Right.
And sometimes it seems like, of course you're supposed to go there. These are all the positive things about it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's where you're going. So the process of discernment is really important.
And how do you learn to honor the voice that challenges you for your good, even though you'd rather deny it, and to let go of the voice that encourages you to do what you want to do, but you have a sneaking suspicion that that might not be the right thing? How do you learn how do you learn the self-control or the dependence on others, or what does it take to practice that?
Today, I'm in a totally different place than I have been in regards to this. Today, what helps me to make those decisions is simply the experiences that I have had in which I have gone somewhere to do something that where everything seemed perfect, and come to have this sense. Things didn't exactly turn out the way that I had thought they would. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean, in my view, that I wasn't supposed to go there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I have been in a situation where, for example, in my mission group, I had gone through this training when I was a teacher, and in a challenging situation in which there was a lot of substance abuse. I got certified as a substance abuse counselor, and I thought, okay, I'm ready to go. And then this other, as Quakers say, way opened, and this whole different experience came. And it's like, but I don't want to go there. You know, I'm ready. You know, right. I'm ready to go here. And it was the community that helped me to see to kind of work through the layers. And in that experience, what was really significant is that at that time, I didn't trust the experience because it seemed too joyful, too happy, too much of a good thing.
What was too much of a good thing?
So I was in a situation mm-hmm. in which, well, the pay wasn't all that great. And here I was going from a situation there to a situation where I would be making much more. There were many challenges in that situation. Mm-hmm. And to me, it felt like this place that I was hearing where Way was opening, it felt like what some folks would say, a temptation, you know?
Rather than a destination or rather than a next step.
And a member of my clearness committee asked me one question. Do you not feel that God would want you to have good things or in a situation in which it would be a good experience for you? And so, you know, and helped me to kind of recognize that that these are not the things that determine whether we should go or whether we should stay.
Right. But my inability, and this has happened to me, my inability to accept good things when they're perfectly fine, but I reject them because I cling to my poverty of my past. That is a crutch. That right. is not opening up. Mm-hmm. options, and I need to let it go, you know. And sometimes letting it go means taking more than you think you may deserve, or that may it will be a temptation to lead you whatever. But until you deal with that kind of success, you can't be non-attached to it.
True. And then I've had the opposite experience in thinking, oh, I'm going from here and this is going to be a challenge, and then just recognize it. It's kind of like, oh God, this is the place I want to be for the rest of my life, you know. Yes. And then, you know, going through that process and just crying and said, oh, I don't want to leave here. It's wonderful. I've made these friends, and going to the next place. And it says, oh God, this is the place I want to be for the rest of my life.
Right.
So, you know.
You just want to live a full life.
I want to live everywhere with everyone. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's delightful. That's delightful. Angela, it's wonderful to get to know you. Thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and it's been good to get to know you as well.
And there is this benefit concert for the Friends Center for Racial Justice that will be at the Unitarian Church on Friday, April 7th at 7:30 p.m. The authors of the Rise Up Singing Songbook and Leah Gilmore, a blues and jazz gospel singer, will be there, and activists. And this is going to be an evening to celebrate our social justice chops. And to sing. Angela, what are we going to close with here? I think This Is My Song was this.
I have a song that has meant a lot to me. It's called, what is it, A Song for All the Nations?
Yes,
This Is My Song. Yeah. And it kind of reflects, I guess, the foundational thing. Some people use the term the beloved community that we're trying to live into, and it just helps me become a stay grounded in that understanding that the sky is over all of us, all over the earth. So, yeah.
Thank you. Here we go.